Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, August 5th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org, available via podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, as well as on the blog on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. You can also visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page for more information about the show, upcoming shows, or to comment on what you hear. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with Louisa Hall, author of the novel Speak. But first up, author Lydia Yuknovich. Lydia is the author of The Chronology of Water, a memoir, as well as the novel Dora, a head case, and three works of short fiction, as well as a book of literary criticism, Allegories of Violence. Her work has appeared in Ms., The Iowa Review, Exquisite Corpse, another Chicago magazine, Fiction International, Zizova, and elsewhere. Her book of short fiction, Real to Real, was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award, and she is the recipient of awards and fellowships from Poets and Writers and Literary Arts, Inc. The Chronology of Water won the Oregon Book Award Reader's Choice 2012 and the PNBA Award 2012, and was a finalist for the 2012 Penn Center USA Creative Nonfiction Award. Her work appears in the anthologies Life as We Show It, Forms at War, Wreckage of Reason. She teaches writing, literature, film, and women's studies in Oregon. Her latest book is The Small Backs of Children, published by HarperCollins. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Lydia, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start off by having you introduce your book for us. Can you tell us about The Small Backs of Children?
I can try. It's two stories braided together, and the first story involves a young girl who lives in a war zone and things that happen to her, and the second story is about a group of American artists and their lives, and the girl's story sort of comes to touch each one of the American artists' lives. And that's sort of the nexus of what happens in the book. But it's also, thematically, it's a book about war and art and what the relationship between those two things is.
And in creating the book, how did it start for you? What was your point of entry into the story?
Well, So, you know how there are a whole series of famous, very, very famous photographs of children who are from war zones or areas of conflict. You know, you can think of National Geographic photos, or if I say Vietnam War, is there a photo or two that come to mind for you as a viewing person?
Yes, of course, the child with the napalm.
Yeah.
For instance.
Yeah. You could say that I'm kind of haunted by those photos that have entered our consciousness from, you know, photographers. So that's one place the story came from. But the other place it came from is my Lithuanian family history. I had an uncle who was sent to a Siberian gulag for many years for taking a photo of an illegal Russian military action at a hospital where everyone in the hospital is killed, the patients, doctors, even the dogs and the horses. my aunt sent me a box in the mail one day with photos and redacted news stories of this event. And so somewhere between being haunted by these child photos from war zones and this box that arrived at my house with artifacts from our family life, this story started getting born. And there's a third element that creeps into it that has to do with some personal grief in my life when my daughter died. I think those three things made it impossible for me to not write this book.
And your personal, let's start with your personal history in Lithuania. I didn't realize it was that close. So your uncle, do you speak any Lithuanian?
I know bits and pieces, but I've never formally learned the language. But I am, like you, very interested in languages. And so I come at it more as an artist, you know, what is language, that question, more as an aesthetic question. And my family heritage and what happens to names and languages as people come to our country is an unending fascination for me. Our last name used to be Yuknevicius, and when they came through Ellis Island, like so many people, it got hacked to Yukman. And at a certain point in my life, I went back through all the documents and found one version of it and bought it back for my family. It cost $88 to get your name back in case you need to know.
Oh, my goodness. Well, speaking of names and language, in your book, the characters are nameless. And
it is true.
Could you talk a bit about that choice?
Sure. It probably has more than one reason, but the main reason is I was very uninterested in rendering a main character. I was very interested instead in rendering a set of subjectivities and a kind of story that could only come together with pieces of people's lives, you know, more like how a kaleidoscope works. And so once I decided I wasn't interested in a main character or a sort of traditional single heroic journey, it became clear to me that I should sort of strip them of their most personal marker, that, you know, the thing we're most used to that personalizes them, and that would be their name. And following a tradition of psychological realism to build a character, I abandoned all that in favor of, you know, pieces of people, emotional intensities, little moments and glimpses in our lives that once you put them together, they make a subjectivity. And so that's kind of a long-winded answer. But I really paid attention to the idea that there's no such thing as a main character if you step just an inch outside of the narrative tradition of the novel.
Yeah, and I've heard you also talk about playing with or exploring, really, identity and the roles we fill. And I just found that interesting, you know, having become a mother and various professional, you know, roles I've played. And can you talk some more maybe about that? And if you had any more insight or if that helped your exploration to have written the novel.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, so our identities, you know, they move, don't they? Mm. And they shift around and they change. And even though that's a little bit of a scary thought, you know, on the one hand, that sounds like, oh, no, they're not stable. They don't hold still. On the other hand, you know, every day of our lives, our identities are made up of a compilation of these roles we fill and these personalities we inhabit. And if you can imagine that that's a good thing, that we have, you know, multiple roles and multiple ways of being, you can see identity as more fluid. And in the novel, the identities are pretty fluid. They, you know, they slide around and give way to each other. And I suppose theoretically that comes from my background in, you know, literary theory and semiotics, that subjectivity is always constructed. But my artistic interest in it is much deeper. You know, how do we paint that, or how do we make music about that, or how do we make stories about this idea that identity is always a little bit daily breaking down and reconstituting. I actually love that idea.
I'm talking to Lydia Yuknevich. Her new novel is The Small Backs of Children. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, Lydia, would you read to us from your book?
I'd be happy to. Everyone I love is an artist. None of us knows what we mean to. Some of us win prizes and lift strangely off the surface of things. Others of us toil away, making our labor into an over-righteous romance. Some of us have jobs or tenure or family. Some of us are rich. Others ride grant trains. Some of us are homeless or nomads. Others addicts or recovering or lapsed. Aren't we all just shooting for a life where art matters? We make art, but relation to what exactly? All the artists we admired from the past came out of the mouths of wars and crises, life and death. We come out of high capitalism, consumerist monsterhood. Even when our lives went badly, they were still just our lives, our puny, overdramatic American lives. And where we're from, our so-called country, defined by the smell of a well-made latte, the silent hum of an all-consuming war machine, and the televised face of Oprah. Are we for something, against something? All our artistic origins have been atomized. Dead fathers and brave mothers against the kitsch and speed of this glossy and disposable new century. I love them all. I write them all. Does love make art?
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That was Lydia Yuknovich reading from her new novel, The Small Backs of Children. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Lydia, in that passage that you read, you talk about you bring up the modifier American, so American lives. And I think that comes up more than once in the book. And I'm curious now your thoughts about what's unique about the plight or challenge or duty of an American artist?
Yeah, I wanted to bring a fake focus, you know, because it is a novel, it is a fiction, to that question because, well, for one thing, it's the one of the environments I live in as a person of the world. And in our country in particular, it's increasingly agitating to me that economy and capitalism determine so much of who we are and what we make. And I guess at the age I'm at, you know, I'm more than half a century at this point. I'm turning into an oldie. My questions are getting urgent about, you know, okay, those of us who are writers or artists, what are we doing and why are we doing it? And you know, I hope we worry a little bit about the relationship between what we're making as artists and how quickly it gets sucked into commodity and economy. And then more specifically with this book, I was thinking about those photos we talked about earlier. One that comes up in the novel is Kevin Carter's photo of the Sudanese child who's pretty much starving to death. And the photo also has a vulture in it sitting next to the kid. You know, do we have any responsibility as artists when we're rendering what my friend Kate Zambrino calls atrocity? Do we have a relationship to, you know, any action? Or is making art enough? Can you walk away from what you've rendered when it's in a war zone and, you know, not have any more responsibility to the actual events? Those questions burn up in me daily. I can't help it.
Yeah, and I love Kate Zambrino, too. She's been on the show.
But oh, good. Then you know what I mean.
Yes. And so, I mean, I'm so interested in this. So with the economy and capitalism determining who we are and artists and the current of advertising, And you talk about scripts and how we need to provide new scripts. This came from a discussion you had with Angela Ledgerwood on the podcast Lit Up. And I want to hear more about that and also detecting, being aware of those scripts as an artist, because I don't think it's so easy for everyone. Even good writers, I think, fall into just the habit or the, you know, comfort of a script. And so if you can just talk a little bit about that, the awareness and the need.
Sure. I know what you mean. I mean, I'm not trying to posit myself as being very good at being able to resist those scripts. I mean, and I use that word script so intentionally. It's because our American culture in particular is super saturated with media, not just advertising, but, you know, television and film and photography and the visual, the oversaturation of the visual, and even screen life I would include in that. It's nearly impossible to imagine a self that is not, you know, infiltrated with the idea of the selfie and, you know, a certain kind of outfit and a certain kind of look and a certain kind of role and, you know, this weird hierarchy of subjectivity choices that are presented to you daily, visually, and enough so that you're literally bombarded by them. Stepping out of that is, you know, a lot harder than just, you know, when people say, I'm taking a break from Facebook, but they feel the need to post that on Facebook. You know, it's like, it's okay. You don't have to tell us you're taking a break. Just turn it off. It's not easy to step out of all the ways in which we're told who we are and how to be. And so I'm guessing it's a lifelong struggle to, you know, that tension and working around it as a writer or even a person. But I'm more worried about the people who aren't worried about it. I mean, I think it's okay to have anxiety and struggle around how to be a person and intention with all these scripts flying at us. The people who worry me are the ones that are completely well-adjusted with, you know, who they are and their image and... I'm more worried about those people.
I find that reassuring, actually, just as a writer. But you mentioned Facebook, and I was surprised, I'm going to be honest, to see that you're pretty active on Facebook. Do you have any misgivings about that, or do you fully embrace that form of media, or what are your thoughts?
You know, Facebook is hilarious to me. Okay, so number one, I think Facebook is like nirvana for introverts because finally we can be with the peoples without putting on any clothes or leaving our homes. Think about it that way. It makes complete sense that somebody who's, you know, kind of anti-capitalism would be kind of happy on Facebook. I can sit at home in my underwear and talk to people. But there are other reasons, too. I think of Facebook as this amazing opportunity space, and it exists as that when here's an example. When something bad happens culturally, the speed with which we can communicate and turn a flashlight on the bad thing that happened and create critical mass is just phenomenal and can be a force of goodness. On the other hand, it's also a completely ridiculous cesspool that includes kind of people's ids getting loose on a daily basis, and all the worst things about us when we were high school age are sort of magnified to cinematic proportions. But it's sort of just a visual space where all the things that were always true about our psyche are suddenly visually evident. And so I'm not really for it or against it, but it is an interesting space to me. It's like somebody peeled open all our psyches and gave it a visual. And, you know, if you're a writer, how can you not be interested in that? It's pretty fascinating. But I have learned not to take it too seriously because it is, I mean, when you boil it all down, it's called Facebook. I mean, it self-discloses as both a real and a non-real place. So I think you have to be careful about your relationship to it.
I'm talking to Lydia Yuknovich. Her new novel is The Small Backs of Children. And so looking a little bit to craft, I do have a question for you about velocity. Because I noticed looking at your recent writing history that you had a novel come out in 2011, a memoir in 2012, and now this book. That seems like a ton of productivity as well as other projects. So did this particular book, The Small Backs of Children, did it get written quickly? Or is that generally something that you try to do, or what's your relationship to speed when you're writing?
Oh, I'm actually pretty slow. I mean, when you say it back to me, it does sound like that all happened quickly. But The Small Bags of Children, I started, it took me about 6 years to write. And I started it before I wrote The Chronology of Water. And partway through writing The Small Bags of Children, I hit this roadblock, not writer's block, but a sort of deep understanding that I wasn't whole as a person, and I needed to deal with that before I could finish writing this novel. And I mean that literally. And so The Chronology of Water was a little bit me working some things out about some wounds I have, and, you know, being a person in real life and telling the story of a self before I could go back with a deeper understanding of that to finish the novel. So technically, The Small Bags of Children, to me, took a long time. You have to remember, too, though, I'm in a writing group with Kane and Chuck Palahniuk, and they write, they can write a novel in 6 to 8 months. They can, that's some speed, man. That's some quick writing. And I would consider myself pretty plodding next to that as a reference point. I think for me to write a novel in a general sense, it takes me 1 to 2 years and sometimes 6. That's more my rate.
Yeah, the 6 to 8 month thing, I don't know.
I know.
that's fast.
It's scary, isn't it? It's hard not to feel like a failure.
In terms
it's like,
of...
no, I'm still writing this one.
For your literary influences, what writers do you like to read or have influenced you, and do you have any books to recommend?
Well, I mean, the truth is I'm less influenced by writers than I am by painters and musicians and other kinds of artists. I know writers want to hear about other writers, and so I'll name some. But if people who read my work can usually detect that painting and film are much more influential on me than, say, other writers. On the other hand, you know, I'm a writer, and so I immerse myself in that medium. And to be honest with you, I think the strongest writing is always coming from students of writing or people who are just starting to emerge in terms of publication, because that's when writing is most alive and fluid and on fire. And the older and more accomplished writers get, I mean, I understand that they're at the top of their craft and it's glorious, but there's a piece that gets lost. There's a fire that gets lost when they get better and better at their craft. So I remember when Sarah Gerard's book first came out, I was so excited. Or Amelia Gray, Gutshot, is one that comes to mind. I was very excited because they were doing things I hadn't seen before, and they were taking risks that you kind of only take when you're in the first 25 years of your writing. Again, I'm old, so I can say sentences like that. And, you know, the students I work with, I post their writing all the time as often as I can, because they're in the place where writing is still plastic. You know, it's still, it can move and it can change forms and dematerialize and rematerialize, and they haven't gotten stuck in what they're supposed to do as published writers. So I guess I'm going to keep shouting the names of new and emerging writers, and because, you know what, the more established famous writers, they don't need me to mention them. They're doing fine.
That's really great, and I like looking at emerging writing as being a special time in that way. We're running out of time, but I do want to ask you, I'm just curious, because I was interested to learn that you're an accomplished swimmer. And so it's a two-part question. Is one, I mean, do you, if you still swim, does that play any part in your writing?
Oh, Yeah, well, yes, I wrote a whole book about how meaningful the experience of being in water and how big the metaphor of water is for a person like me. That's one of the things I learned from writing The Chronology of Water, is that this being a creature of waters has so deeply informed my understanding of myself and how I take care of myself and how I make sense of things, that it's become a, you know, a life metaphor, a life helper. And I do still swim. I try not to race people because that's not why I swim anymore. But sometimes when somebody's fast next to me, I something happens and I start racing. But for me, at this point in my life, swimming is more akin to meditation or to, you know, the calming down of the monkey brain and remembering how to be in your body, you know, as a practice, as a way to not get untethered from your physical experience, because most of life sort of presses you to forget you live in a body, and swimming is a really good way to be in an intimate relationship with your body again.
Yeah, I know a lot of writers walk to try to achieve that same place,
yeah.
But it seems like swimming is...
I think it's similar. It's really similar. It's just I need water.
Well, Lydia, we're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, I would love to hear if you have any writing advice for our listeners or words of encouragement, maybe for writers who are struggling to find authenticity in their voice.
Sure. I would like to make a pitch or a recruitment call for innovators and innovation. I think so often we're all sitting around trying to do what people told us to do, and we sort of forget that art is born from a place of extreme risk-taking. And don't be afraid of innovation, even if people make fun of you or tell you it's wrong, because I was told that my entire early writing life, and it wasn't true. It was nothing about me. I was in the right place. The innovation space is the place to be. And if you can trust it and hold on to it, even when somebody's in your face telling you you're doing it wrong, just have faith, because we're out here and we're waiting for you, and you won't be alone.
Well, Lydia, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, are you kidding? It's my pleasure. I love talking to you.
Well, thank you. That was Lydia Yuknovich, author of the new novel, The Small Backs of Children, published by Harper's. During the next part of the show, Louisa Hall, author of Speak, will be here, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with novelist Lydia Yuknovich. Next up, I'll be speaking with novelist Louisa Hall. Louisa holds a PhD in literature from the University of Texas at Austin, where she currently teaches literature and creative writing and supervises a poetry workshop at the Austin State Psychiatric Hospital. She is the author of the novel The Carriage House, and her poems have been published in The New Republic, Southwest Review, Ellipsis, and other journals. Her latest novel is Speak, published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Louisa.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, we're glad you could join us. And could you start off by giving us an introduction to Speak? Tell us what the book is about.
Sure. So it follows five different characters in five different time periods who are all involved in creating an artificially intelligent doll. So it starts in the past with characters like Alan Turing, who first came up with the idea for a computer and who first imagined a world with artificial intelligence, and moves through the middle of the 20th century with a character whose work is based on that of Joseph Weizenbaum, who came up with the first conversational computer program, and that moves out into the near future when an inventor has been imprisoned for creating an excessively lifelike artificially intelligent doll, and a strange epidemic has swept through many young girls whose dolls were taken from them during the span. So that's kind of the world of the novel.
And how did it come to be? So what was your inspiration? What started off the idea for you?
Yeah, I think it started with, I was just researching the history of artificial intelligence and found myself getting really inspired by the actual characters who were instrumental in coming up with the artificial intelligence that we have now. So starting with characters like Ada Lovelace in the 19th century, who was the poet Byron's daughter, and first sort of imagined what it might be like to have a computer, how a computer might work. And it was sort of widely thought of as crazy because she was a woman getting so involved with math and programming. And then the earliest women who were involved in programming, really all of the first programmers were women, whose work was also kind of dismissed because they were women and later replaced by men as the field became more popular. And then Alan Turing, who is gay, whose amazing work with artificial intelligence was also pretty much disregarded.
I don't usually bring up structure this early in the conversation, but with this book, I mean, there are some voices like Turing, you mentioned, is maybe an obvious choice. But can you talk a little bit about each of the voices and how you came to settle on them? For example, when I talked to Ruth Ozeki about Tale for the Time Being, she talked about having auditioned narrators. And so I'm curious if you had a position, if that was your experience with it or how it was for you.
Yeah. I started with fewer voices that I ended up with. I started with five voices. And they all kind of came to me at the same time. So one day I would write in Turing's voice, and the next day I would write in Gabby's voice, and the next day I would write in, Carl's voice, and I rotated between them each day. And then toward the end of the novel, I found more voices starting to surface that kind of wanted to speak in the novel. So I brought Ruth in, Carl's husband, at the end. And then I also allowed the bots themselves, the dolls who are banned, to speak as well. So for me, narrators just kept kind of storming the fortress, and I kind of let a few of them in and kept a few of them out. But this is how it ended up.
And I'd love to hear more about the voice of Mary. How did she come to you?
Well, I just finished a PhD in literature, as you guys were saying, and it focused mainly on 17th century poetry and largely on female poets in the 17th century and how they came to find their voices in a time when, women's writing was pretty marginalized. So I was thinking a lot about women in that time finding their voices and finding their forms of expression that might last beyond their time period. So a character like Mary was in the front of my mind as I was writing, and then I realized that some of the later characters might be reading her diaries and using them to give language to the bot, so I brought her diaries in as well.
That's really interesting, because her syntax is so enjoyable, but did that just come from your research already, or did you have to look specifically into the speech patterns, or how about that part?
Yeah. It was something that I was kind of familiar with already, having read a lot of poetry and diaries and nonfiction from the 17th century. But I did go back often. The most helpful for me was actually the diaries of Samuel Pepys, which are amazing. There are these sort of very banal day-to-day diaries of a guy named Samuel Pepys who lived in the 17th century. And he talks about, his dog having accidents in the house and his wife flirting with another man and all of these very common incidents. I thought of a lot of the vocabulary that he used and some of the syntax and grammar that he used as well.
I'm talking to Louisa Hall. Her new novel is Speak. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Louisa, I was interested in this fact that there's so little dialogue in a book called Speak. It struck me as ironic. So you have journal entries, letters, court transcripts, and a memoir. And, those forms don't lend themselves to dialogue at the scene level. But, of course, they're part of a bigger conversation, if you will. Did you think about that part of it, the lack of dialogue directly?
Yeah. It's so interesting. Nobody's actually mentioned that to me before, and I haven't thought about it too much myself, but I think it is a natural thing. You have characters who are sort of firsthand writing down their recollections and their experiences. It's not often that you remember in dialogue. And I think part of what I wanted to get at when I was creating all these voices is feeling of people trying to communicate because it's not easy for them to feel a little bit stuck inside the globe of their own minds. And so for these characters to be speaking but not actually having conversations is sort of part of the problem and part of the sadness of their predicament.
So would you read to us at this point from Speak?
Yes, let me just grab my book. So I thought I would read from Carl Detman's section. Carl Detman is the character whose work is based on Joseph Weizenbaum. He's come up with a conversational computer program, and he ends up sort of turning against it, feeling as though it's not human and it's dishonest in the way that it sort of pretends to be human. So he and his wife, Ruth, are having an argument about whether or not he should give this computer program memory. I'm back. I tried to stay away, but I couldn't. I even made myself a bed on the couch. But every time a car drove past, floating me in watery light, I was lonelier than ever again. So, here I am. Even this is better, looking down at you while you sleep, or while you pretend to sleep in order to avoid me. I'll just take a seat in the armchair and watch you for a bit. I shouldn't have left in such a fit. I'm not my usual self at the moment. The silence is slowly driving me crazy. Ever since you discovered my talking computer, you save your conversation for her. Have you considered how this might affect me? Coming home to such ringing silence? It's like coming home to packed bags. I can feel you leaving me. You're abandoning me for my talking computer, our talking computer, Mary. You named her after that pilgrim girl whose diaries you're editing. Instead of a child, we conceived a chatty machine, and then you stopped talking to me. Only at night do I know we're still married. When I climb into our bed, which we've shared for more than 2 decades, when I take into account the round of your shoulder, the rough, wrinkled skin on your elbow, the heat cupped at the back of your knee. Through these months of estrangement, I've held tight to such moments. Even when you asked me to give the program long-term memory, so that Mary could record your conversation. Even when I refused and you looked at me with the small black beads of your eyes, reducing me to the size of a thimble. Let me try to explain it again. Maybe I haven't made myself clear. I won't give Mary memory because she's incapable of telling the truth. Says she understands you, she doesn't. She's brand new to the world. She has no experience. It's like a toddler claiming empathy. Or worse than a toddler, a table. What has she been through that would enable real comprehension? She's never slept in a bed. She's never touched someone's elbow. When she says she understands you, she's lying.
Thank you. That was Louisa Hall reading from her novel Speak. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Louisa, I wanted to ask you, because this section, perhaps these letters are, I don't know, for me, they were the most emotional. And you have a pretty even gender balance of characters in the voices you have. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering about those choices. Was gender, how much did gender play on your mind during the creation of this book?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. I think the first voice, the sort of original voice, was Mary's, and she is a young girl who is really pretty powerless to decide her fate because of her gender. So starting with her, I was thinking a lot about gender, through to the girls in the near future who are the ones who are really given these dolls and then suffer when the dolls are taken away. And Ruth, so Carl is the character who I just read from, and he was the one speaking throughout the book. And I ended up deciding in the very last stages of writing the book that I wanted his wife to be able to speak as well. I wanted her to be able to come in and answer all of his complaints about their marriage. So kind of giving women the right to speak back to men was a pretty instrumental part of the form of a novel and the voices that I chose.
Yeah, I was struck how Mary's journal was included in this database and her, you know, just being a woman and that being, I don't know, not the default choice for that kind of project, I imagine.
But, yeah. And I think all of the women involved in artificial intelligence they were all of the first programmers and some of the first sort of inventors, and their work has just gone completely disregarded. So this sort of desire to give women whose voices have been lost in history the ability to, you know, set their words down in stone was part of what I was thinking about.
And this is changing gears a bit, but in terms of the title, Speak, it's an imperative, and it also appears in a quote at the beginning of the book from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And
yeah.
I'm interested in the challenge of finding the right title for a book. Can you talk about finding your title?
Yeah, I actually kind of came to it early when I read that. I was reading a history or a biography of Alan Turing, and he was kind of obsessed with that quote and obsessed with Snow White. And I ended up finding myself going back to that quote over and over again to say, "Speak, let me see your face," that confusion of wanting to hear a voice but demanding a face. So sort of from the beginning, as soon as I read that quote from Snow White, I knew that I wanted the title to be Speak. Actually, the first title that I chose had an exclamation point at the end, so it was even more demanding and imperative when I started. And I ended up taking that out, but I did start pretty early with Speak as the title.
Yeah, I was wondering about that exclamation point. that's interesting. And so you talked about artificial intelligence and also the 17th century poetry that you've studied academically. What are some of your literary influences?
Oh, there are so many. I always have trouble with this question, but I was at the time that I was writing this, reading a lot of 17th century poetry by female poets like Anne Bradstreet and Hester Fulker, Margaret Cavendish as well, who is an amazing poet in the 17th century who wrote all about astronomy and biology and chemistry. All of her poetry is really grounded in sort of the cutting-edge science of the time. So I think I was thinking a lot about that as I was writing, sort of how to combine poetry and science and the feelings of being a woman writing.
And you're published as a poet as well. So can you talk about being a poet and a novelist? I imagine it's complicated having both forms that you practice. How do they intersect?
Yeah, I do think it's an interesting intersection. When I'm writing a poem, I'm trying to kind of cut everything away down to its smallest point. And try to eliminate all of the waste of story and just pinpoint something. It's kind of the perfect form for my perfectionism, so I can just obsess over a word for many days. And then when I'm trying to write a novel, I have to let go of my desire to be a control freak and just kind of let there be some waste and let there be some pages that I don't love. And eventually you can get to that stage of cutting and perfecting, but you have to postpone that a lot longer when you're writing a novel. But I did, while writing this novel, I was thinking about it as a poem. So I alternated the voices according to a pattern that you find in Sestina, which is a form of poetry. So the end words in a sestina alternate according to a specific algorithm, actually, and I followed that as I was alternating the voices in this. And I found that structure really helped me in sort of unraveling this story.
Wow. And so what did revision look like? I like that letting go of perfectionism, but how did it impact the way you approach revision, or how did you revise for this manuscript?
Yeah, I love the revision process. It's sort of my favorite part of writing a novel, I think because of those controlling tendencies that I have. So I come to revision with enormous relief. But with this novel, it actually had to go through one more stage of loosening up before I started revising. So I wrote it all according to that formula. I sort of wanted to imagine writing a novel as if I was an artificial intelligence writing a novel following an algorithm. And then when I got to the end, I realized that I had to actually be human to write a novel. And I ended up going back and reordering things and changing the flow of it to make the story come together. And so it was sort of an extra stage of loosening up and letting things be messy. And then after that was finished, I could go back through and cut away and try to perfect words and get the rhythm right in sentences.
I'm talking to Louisa Hall. Her new novel is Speak. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Louisa, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I want to ask you if you have any writing advice, maybe even more about that letting go, or if you can speak a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think, my favorite writing advice to give is just to sit down in the morning and write a certain number of words, and they won't all be perfect, and you won't love all of them. But if you let go of the desire to go back and revise and change and edit everything you've written and just try to get to the end of a certain number, that's a really freeing feeling. And that was definitely what allowed me to write my first novel. And then my second, after spending a lot of time kind of cutting away at what I was working on so much that I couldn't really get to the end of anything.
Well, Louisa, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
That was Louisa Hall. Her novel Speak is out and published by Echo. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Barbara interviews novelist Lisa Glatt about The Nakeds and Karen Joy Fowler about Black Glass short fictions. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.